Chapter 18. Voyaging. On Sea Sprite, Cressa fretted ceaselessly about her daughter and what Matwick might be doing to hunt her. After they had cast off from the Eastern Duchies, she had enchanted all the souls on board to make them forget the ship's anchorage in the deserted bay close to Winton. So no one knew where her daughter hid now, except for herself and, of course, Cerulea. Also, she was plagued by a nagging fear that she had erred by fleeing from the conspiracies that surrounded her, rather than facing them. Had this been dishonourable? Still, surrounded by the sea, Cressa could breathe more easily. The current seamaster, Bashkim, skinny with a permanent squint, had once been Ambrice's second mate, and she recognised many of the sailors. On the ocean and among people she trusted, Cressa felt safer than she had in a long time. So much of her youth had been spent voyaging. Cressa often stood at the rail, smelling the salt spray, enjoying the sunshine making the swells sparkle, relishing her freedom from confinement, sometimes turning the braid of Cerulea's hair round and round. Cressa realised that while she often compared herself unfavourably to her stern mother, her father's seafaring blood also coursed through her. She took her meals with Seamaster Bashkim and Captain Clemson, men without guile, who offered her their unvarnished opinions, but followed her commands without demur. The three discussed the next course of action at length. Although the Nargis throne had many allies, only two courses presented themselves as viable. East, to her father in Lothrod, or south, to rendezvous with her husband. East would have been the obvious choice because of both size and location. Lothrod was a great and powerful realm, while Ambrice had only a few ships under his command. Moreover, Cressa had sent Ambrice to deal with the Pellish pirates marauding the Green Isles. But with more than 500 isles, no one knew exactly where Sea Pearl might be found. Both Clemson and Bashkim urged the prudent easterly course. But her enemies would be expecting that choice. Might they waylay her one vessel at sea? Besides, what help would her father offer? He no longer ruled as king, having abdicated and placed his oldest son, her half-brother Rickil, on the walrus throne. Rickil was a cautious man. He would regret his half-sister's troubles. He would rue the internal turmoil in Weirendale. He would certainly offer her and her crew polite and comfortable sanctuary for all the years ahead. She would find safety there, but Rickil would not send his people to war for Weirendale. Now, if Mikkel, her younger half-brother, had been king, she might have risked the voyage. When she was a child, Mikkel, though still 8 summers older, had spent much more time with her. Mikkel and she had a closer bond, and Mikkel had a more emotional and less judicious temperament. He would have taken the threat to her personally, as an affront to Lothrod. Overruling her advisor's advice, Cressa decided that the ship should head south toward the Isles and Ambrice. South, away from Androvale and Cerulea's hiding place. It might take her some time to find Sea Pearl, but this decision would make it just as hard for any ship from Cascada to hunt Sea Sprite. In general, Cressa found relief in the easy comradeship of a small ship, as opposed to the formality of the palace. She joined with the Queen's Shield in mourning bristle and congratulated Darius and Yanath when Clemson promoted them to sergeants. Clemson assigned his female shields, Kinley, the stocky one with dark brown hair cut very short and a flat, bridged nose, and Sina, the tall, muscled one who had fought in Cerulea's bedchamber, to wait upon the Queen. In her cabin, she attempted to get acquainted with her new attendants. "I know you both signed up as soldiers. Are you content with these duties?"
"Sure, Your Majesty, Mum," said Sina. Precious little for Shields to do on a ship anyway. And Captain Clemson has excused us from mucking out the horse stalls in exchange.
Well, that's the first time I've been told I am more interesting than horse manure, Cressa commented.
What was your life like before? She asked. How did you join the Shield?
To her shock, Cena scowled darkly.
I'll tell you if you so command, but do you need to know these things for me to fetch and carry for you?
Cressa's mouth fell open at this rudeness to her friendly overture, and she glanced at Kinley.
She doesn't know, Kinley said to the other guard.
Right, I suppose she don't. She should, though.
But who'd tell her?
Cena shrugged.
Kinley turned to the Queen. You didn't know, Your Majesty, but the custom is that no one ever asks Shields about their past.
And why not? Puzzled Cressa.
Because it might be something bad or worse if one joined the Shield to fight and die. If you're a woman, well, it's bound to be something triple bad.
I see, said Cressa slowly. Please forget I asked.
Cressa changed the subject by holding out her ripped grey silk gown.
Do either of you know how to sew?
Nope,
said Cena,
and not I, said Kinley. And the three burst out laughing at their incompetence at a task that any village woman would have mastered.
Hey, I've an idea, give it here, said Kinley.
Come back soon, called the Queen. I can't go on deck without my gown.
As time slipped by, Cressa grew impatient.
I'm going to have to send you to scrounge clothing from the smaller men, she said to Cena, when at that moment Kinley returned, her grin showing her bad teeth.
Sailors know how to sew, said Kinley, demonstrating that the rent had been neatly patched with sailcloth.
When Cressa came out on deck in her patched gown, all the sailors clapped. And the Queen played to the joke by twirling around.
Excuse me, Your Majesty, said Seamaster Bashkin, breaking in on the levity. We need to put in for provisions at the next trading port.
Which is?
Yoster, a town on the coast of the Free State Wiget.
And if Matwick has agents there?
Yoster's a busy port. Probably 20 ships a day coming and going. With our name painted over and flying no flags, we'll be a ghost. Do your enemies have spies in every port, checking every vessel?
Probably not yet, but soon. We must not dally. Get supplies and shove off. No shore leave for any of the men, and always be prepared for trouble.
Very good, Your Majesty.
Cressa wanted to watch the provisioning from the deck, but Cena grabbed the back neck of her gown and yanked her inside the captain's mess hall.
Your hair! Your royal stone, did you forget?
Kinley agreed.
Even if we covered you up, 'twould look queer to have a delicate lady on board. Best keep out of sight.
You're right, agreed Cressa. Sometimes I forget my position, especially aboard the ship.
Ah, Queenie, said Kinley in a mock scold. Good thing sensible folks stand by to remind and protect you.
Cressa laughed and accepted the informality, enjoying the new fellowship with her shields. Sea Sprite passed unquestioned at Yoster, and 3 weeks later, when they stopped at one of the northernmost isles, they asked discreetly for any word of Ambrice's ship, but heard no tidings. They headed deeper into the Green Isles, which poked out of the sea in clusters. Whether vast or small, most towered above the ship, showing their volcanic origins and steeply raked sides. Being covered by verdant foliage, all lived up to their name. Mist lingered on their peaks and fell in folds in the water passageways, so Bashkin picked their way with care until Sea Sprite broke out into open seas again. Whenever the wake grew choppy, both Kinley and Cena became nauseous. Cressa cast around for subjects that might distract them and found that they were happy to talk about their recent sexual adventures.
Kinley proved to have a fund of surprisingly funny dirty jokes, which he told with perfect timing. Does it cause problems amongst the guards if you dally with them? Asked Cressa. She was sitting idly on her bunk, picking at loose embroidery threads on her gown. Sina sat on the floor, sharpening the queen's dagger, while Kinley on the chair polished the queen's salt-stained boots.
It might, if you ever allowed it to get serious, answered Sina. If you ever allowed a fella to feel as if he had a claim on you. So I make sure the man knows this roll around is just a yen, and we both keep away from the queen's shield.
Do you two ever think about marriage? Cressa asked.
Sina and Kinley both hooted.
Marriage, said Kinley. Guards are really good candidates for marriage. We drink too much, fuck around too much, die too often. They're dumb. We like to fight. And if you ain't noticed, they pick their noses and their feet.
That's not fair, Cressa protested. All the Queen's Shield is brave and well-spoken.
And there ain't on one of them that would make a good husband, said Sina.
Except maybe,
she exchanged a glance with Kinley.
Who?
Pressed the Queen.
Sergeant Yanneth, Your Majesty,
Sina answered a bit reluctantly.
Yanneth? Really?
Bramwise is handsomer. Clemson has authority.
She stopped, embarrassed to have revealed that she'd noticed her shields as men.
Kinley dropped the boot she was working on with a bawdy laugh.
Ha ha! Ponto is so young he can't control that big bulge in his pants, can he? It ain't like we haven't noticed.
Sina chimed in on top of her.
How could you miss it?
But trust us, Queenie. You want a steady man, a smart man, a good man. Yanneth's the one,
Kinley enlightened her liege.
I mean, they're all the greatest chaps and we'd die for any of them, but marriage material, only Yanneth.
Cressa had never particularly paid attention to Yanneth. He spoke less often than some of the men and his physique did not stand out.
I'll have to figure out what you see in him, she said thoughtfully.
But just talking about men makes me miss my husband something fierce.
In return, though really it was a poor return, during empty hours, Cressa taught her female shields to play oblongs and squares with Captain Bashkim's board. Kinley picked up the strategy quickly and crowed with delight when she slaughtered her opponent. Sina lost like a duck.
Although formality broke down on Sea Sprite, Cressa kept to one rule. She forbade any discussion of the Princella.
When they put in at Slagos, one of the largest ports of the lush green isles, protected by high stone towers on both sides of the harbour, Bashkim's mate learned that Sea Pearl had herself stopped to reprovision not long ago. But when the drinking water merchant started asking questions of the mate, she thought it wisest to conclude her business and leave. In the end, Sprite did not find Sea Pearl. The Pearl found her. It happened this way. 2 weeks after leaving Slagos, crisscrossing the major sailing routes, Sea Sprite stumbled into the tail end of a typhoon. Cressa had experienced storms before, but she discovered that a tropical typhoon, fed by warm water, roared with rare fury. Rain fell in solid curtains, not in drops, and the sea rose in jagged peaks, not waves. The sea sucked one sailor overboard. Bashkim pulled in all sails. Even so, the wind raged so forcefully, the foremast snapped in two with an abrupt, terrifying crack. Below deck, Cressa, watching Sina's and Kinley's vomiting, became seasick for the first time in her life, and then, like the rest of the afflicted, suffered dehydration.
Although she managed to anticipate the worst rolls and brace herself, some of her shipmates broke bones from being tossed about so violently. Cressa stumbled through the pitching passageway to find fresh water for everyone and help splint bones. She heard the horses thrashing about and screaming in terror. When the storm finally died down, Seamaster Bashkim declared they needed to put to shore at the first possible harbour. Later that day, the lookout spotted a small island ahead in the fog, so tiny it wasn't even on their maps. Using their oars to circle it, they found a natural harbour. Sprite pulled in, anchoring as close as possible to a sandy shore that stretched as long as the Great Ballroom and offered almost as deep a white meadow of beach until the tree line closed in. The sailors used the ship's rowboat to ferry scouts to survey the island's safety. Cressa rowed in the second relay with the worst injured. She refused to be carried when the sailors disembarked, wading through the thigh-deep water impatiently, further taxing her already quite distressed grey silk gown. On land, she organised the care of the worst-off casualties. She had no particular skill at nursing, but most of the needs involved just common-sense measures, such as splints, poultices, washing, food and water. After most of the people were ashore, her shields led the horses down the gangway and made them swim to the beach. Before the storm, they had exercised the horses as much as possible by walking them back and forth in the hold. But the 10 mounts had suffered greatly. One poor gelding was too weak to swim the distance. Despite their best efforts to hold up his heavy head, he slipped under the water's surface and didn't rise again. The first day on land, caring for the most severely injured was all that the comparatively hale could stir to accomplish. When their dizziness abated on the second day, Sina and Kinley fashioned a private tent for the Queen out of sailcloth, and Bashkim used the same material to make a canopy to keep the sun off their worst casualties. Sailors searched for the right-sized tree to cut down for a new mast, while shields groomed the salt off the horses and started to exercise them along the beach. The horses sampled the ample greenery near the shore, finding some of it to their liking. The third day, the Queen and six of her shields mounted up to search the island. They had sweet water on board Sprite, but life would be easier if they found a source nearby. Also, any fresh food they could gather would be a welcome change. The lush foliage on the island slowed the riders' passage, and away from the breeze on the beach, insects swarmed. Cressa silently thanked Kinley for the foresight of forming her a makeshift head covering out of the tail of a sailor's shirt. She pulled her now tattered sleeves closer around her and tried to swish the biters away from Night Mist, who flicked her tail at every step, huffed the bugs out of her nostrils and shivered the skin on her neck. Her mare had handled the stresses better than most of their string, but she had lost weight, her muscle tone was poor, and the condition of her coat would have made the palace stableman weep. Smoke was even worse off. Fractious, he allowed only Pontol to care for or ride him. He would bite anyone else who came near, baring his teeth even at the Queen. Cressa on Night Mist, shield Pontol on Smoke, Captain Clemson with a broken left wrist from being smashed against the deck, and four more guards stumbled onto a patch of small wild musk melons. The soldiers sliced open a few and ate them on the spot, and then gathered as many as they could carry, awkwardly tucked inside their shirts, to take back to their companions. The Queen undid her headpiece and turned it into an impromptu sack. Uphill from the melon patch, the scouting party discovered a spring of fresh water. Men would need to come back with kegs, but the scouting party let the horses drink their fill and washed the itchy salt and melon juice off their own faces, necks and forearms. Then the riders headed back to their companions on the beach. However, when they emerged from the dense foliage, they were shocked to see a black-sailed galliot in the harbour
and a sizable group of disreputable-looking men climbing out of three skiffs pulled up on the sand. Sun-bleached rags covered their heads. They were barefoot, with breeches that ended above the knee. Their mostly black waistcoat skirts had a dull sheen to them, as if they had been oiled against the wet. Their arms were bare, except most wore black forearm braces, some of leather, some just of wrapped cloth.
"Who might you be?"
Captain Clemson moved forward to challenge the newcomers. The leader of the landing party, who had two locks of pink hanging over his ears, looked at Clemson with a dark scowl. If he recognised the significance of the men's silver breastplates or the Queen's untidy blue hair, he gave no sign.
"Not your business. I have business with that jewel on her forehead. It's a beaut. Hand it over, right quick."
Cressa could not hand over her royal stone, even if she had wanted to. Royal stones stayed on the Queen's persons while they lived and melted away into Nargis water once they died. "I can't," she tried to explain. "It sticks to my skin."
"Then I'll cut it off," said the pirate, grabbing the handle of his cutlass.
With a clatter, Clemson and the rest of the shield immediately pulled their own swords. So did all the pirates. Only Yaneth and Bramwise had their bows handy. They knocked arrows. Sea sprite sailors, round-eyed with fear and surprise, dived for weapons, coming up with axes or rowboat oars. While Cressa sat on her horse with her mouth open, the antagonists circled each other warily, sizing up each other's skill and ferocity. Pontol clucked his horse between her and their opponents. All at once, several of the pirates rushed in the direction of the canopy under which the most severely injured men lay, perhaps thinking to take the casualties hostage. Clemson could not allow this. He kicked his horse and spurted between the pirates and their prey. As a melee ensued, a pirate grabbed Cressa's stirrup. Instinctively, she stabbed at him with her dagger. When he jerked away, she lost her grasp of its hilt. Another pirate tried to yank her off her saddle. Cressa tried to summon her talent, but she couldn't keep her hand on the man consistently. So instead, she smashed him in the head with the muskmelon bag, startling him into loosing his grip on her waist. Desperate skirmishes broke out all around her. Pirates tried to unhorse the riders. Riders used their height and speed advantage to cut down the pirates. Sailors fiercely swung their improvised weapons. More practiced pirates closed in with cutlasses and maces. Men cursed while startled horses reared and neighed. Cressa saw Clemson lop off a man's head. Watching the blood spurt from the empty neck, she was momentarily transfixed by shock. Kinley, with a wicked smile on her face, fought two-handed with a sword and a buckler. She ducked low and used her surprising speed to bash knees or stab deep into groins. Sergeant Darius already had a broken leg from an injury during the storm. He swung the rough crutch they had fashioned for him to keep the pirates away from his canopy mates. All at once, Smoke went berserk, biting, kicking and bucking so ferociously that Pontol fell off. Pirates immediately swarmed around the shield lying prone in the sand. Cressa yanked Nightmist in a tight circle, intending to go to Pontol's aid. At that moment, an ear-splitting whistle caused hostilities to pause.
"Back to the ship!" the leader of the Pellish pirates shouted. "Look yonder!"
Yonder, all saw Sea Pearl speeding into their harbour with sails belled taut in the wind and all 24 four-person oars stroking. The Pellish tried to flee to their beached boats, but turning their backs on the shore combatants proved a mistake. Bashkim smote one man down with an oar to his head. Pontol, now afoot, skewered the pirate closest at hand and chased after another, swinging his sword with deadly intent.
On his own accord, Smoke ran down a Pelishman who had just reached the water's edge, kicking him with such force that Cressa heard bones crack. The man fell face down in the shallows and did not rise again. Cressa urged Nightmist to collide with a pirate, sending him sprawling. The fleeing Pelish filled only one skiff and rowed it frantically toward their home ship. Although her shield still fought with the left-behind remnants of their attackers, Cressa gazed transfixed by the drama in the harbour waters. The skiff almost made it to the Pelish vessel just as Sea Pearl's keel bore down on it and crushed it like kindling. A rapid adjustment of sail and shouted commands then swung the Carrack sharply starboard with a powerful lurch, and its pointed bowsprit punched a hole in the pirate galleot. The ship was hopelessly damaged. Sergeant Yanath ran up to her, breaking her trance.
"Your Majesty, are you all right? Drought, damn our stupidity. We should have raced you into the forest away from all this."
"Aye, what about everyone else?" Cressa looked around her, then yelled across the beach, unable to keep panic out of her voice. "Sina! Kinley!"
Sina waved her sword in the air so Cressa could spot her. Kinley knelt on the ground near the tree cover next to a prostrate sailor, but she roared out,
"I'm over here, Queenie! No worries!"
Yanath helped her dismount, and Cressa turned her attention back to her men to see what could be done for the wounded. The pirates had killed 5, 3 sailors and 2 of the Queen's shield, one of whom had busted his head against a bulwark during the typhoon and might not have survived anyway. Nearly everyone else was wounded. The only question was how badly and who could be saved. Cressa was concentrating on holding a ripped piece of grey silk on the third mate's gory upper arm, which had taken the points of a mace, when other hands, cleaner hands, came into her field of vision, and a male voice said,
"Let me do that. I can put more pressure on the wound."
She gave way and stood up, pushing her hair out of her way with her bloody, sandy hands. She noticed that Sea Pearl had sent several boats ashore and that healers with medical supplies were rushing to aid the combatants, while unfamiliar sailors dealt with the disarmed or injured pirates and still more caught and soothed the horses that had bolted away from the smell of blood and death. With the arrival of reinforcements, Cressa had time to realise, with no small degree of amazement, that she, who had trembled before her counsellors, had just been through a battle with Pelish pirates. She shook her head wonderingly, trying to control her panting, and gazed all around her again. There, on the beach, looking hale, fit, and disgustingly tidy, stood Ambrice, Lord of the Ships, tall and broad of shoulder in his blue uniform with gold buttons, his coily brown hair, as always, neatly tied at the nape of his neck. In the midst of all the chaos, Cressa felt the piercing desire that Ambrice habitually aroused in her. Their eyes locked. He went down on one knee in the formal bow of a loyal subject reporting to the Queen of Weirendale. On wobbling legs, she ran into his arms, their embrace crushing between them the last, smallest muskmelon tucked inside the bodice of her gown.
"We've been looking for you everywhere!" Cressa cried to Ambrice, perched on his knee, arms around his neck.
"I've been looking for you! Well, not you exactly, but Sprite. We spotted her on the horizon just before the typhoon. I would recognise that silhouette anywhere. Why has her name been painted over?"
"That's all you care about, Sprite."
"Well, I didn't know you were on it. I thought you had sent Sea Sprite after me with a message. Why are you on it? What in water's name are you doing here?"
His hand came up from around the side of her waist, covered red.
"Wait. Is this your blood or someone else's?"
No, of course not mine, said Cressa. That is, I don't recall getting struck. That is, I hadn't realized.
And then her vision narrowed to a pinhole, and she lost consciousness.
When she came to, she was lying on a pallet in her canvas tent. Her side hurt. It had been stitched up neatly, and she was now wearing a long white shirt free of both blood and melon pulp. Sina sat on a driftwood log close at hand, massaging her own bandaged knuckles and watching her intently through the tent's opening.
Her Majesty wakes, she called to someone.
Ambrise appeared immediately.
How are you? Will you drink some wine?
I don't know how I am. What happened?
He helped her raise her head and sip out of a cup.
Some villain stabbed you in the side, but the blade skidded off a lower rib.
Why didn't I know I was hurt? Asked Cressa.
It's not unusual in the heat of battle to miss a small wound. Your dander was up and then you concentrated on helping your men. You only noticed it when I saw it.
And then I fainted. How humiliating.
Nonsense. You fainted from blood loss, not hysterics. Your gown was quite wet. Here, drink some more. How does it feel?
Cressa inventoried the fiery throb.
It hurts.
I'll wager it does. But my healers assure me you're going to be fine. The knife went deep through your skin and that luscious beard above your hip, but did no serious damage. I am the luckiest of men.
He kissed her forehead. Cressa gingerly tried to move about. Ambrise gently pushed her down.
My healers counsel that, as the weather is fine, better not to shift any of you for a couple of days. We will make repairs and let your crew recover.
How fare my men? Can Bashkim and Clemson report to me?
Aye, neither is too badly off. I'll have them fetched in a few moments.
Ambrise urged her to drink a little more and held her slantwise against his warm and broad chest, gently stroking her hair. Bashkim had lost only his right earlobe, but the bandage around his ear sagged low with blood. Clemson displayed a long but not deep gash above his knee and half his face puffed with cuts and bruises.
I didn't know you could fight like that, Your Majesty, said Clemson.
Nor did I, she answered him. Musk melons are not my usual weapon. Give the men my compliments. They fought so stoutly. Go, rest, my captains.
She exhaled, discovering that the motion of her chest caused her wound to hurt.
Tonight, we lie in safe harbour. As if from far away, Cressa heard Ambrise giving orders about posting watches, fetching food, carting water from the spring, and more juice of the poppy for the wounded. Just before she drifted off, she realised that the wine he had urged her to drink had been drugged. Later, she felt him lie down beside her and gently draw close so that she was aware of his warmth against her back. The pain in her side receded a few more steps. She slept. In the morning, the passengers and crew of the Sprite awoke to the throbs of their wounds. The men and women gave the Queen and her consort privacy to talk. In the presence of her husband, Cressa felt whole, completed. Ambrise had been born the eldest son of a master shipwright in the coastal duchy Maritima. When he was a lad, his father had fallen hard into his cups. His mother had left her drunkard husband, taking her infant children with her, but leaving Ambrise behind. So Ambrise's grandmother had kept him in victuals and clothes, while his father had slowly fought for his sobriety and even more slowly earned back the esteem of the Nishta shipyard's owners. From childhood,
Ambrice knew all the inner sinews of a ship, but the sea called him rather than the carpentry shed. He enlisted in the Royal Navy at 15 as an ordinary seaman. Since he exuded steadiness, calm, and a wry sense of humour, and since he never touched a dram of spirits, he rose quickly through the ranks. Now, he wore leadership like a second skin, and his men adored him. Cressa told Ambrice all about the treachery of her counsellors, the involvement of the Oros, and her hiding Cerulea away. I had to protect Cerulea, but it was cowardly for me to flee. Who knows what the counsellors will do to the realm?
You were alone and in grave danger. You did the best you could.
He shook his head.
My little rascal.
Ambrice rummaged in a leather purse and pulled out a small coral bracelet.
I bought this for her in Pelagos.
He toyed with the beads as they talked.
I wonder if she's lonely or frightened. I grieve for her, but you did right to secrete her away. No, don't tell me where. If ever I am captured, it's best that I don't know.
Now that I have found you, or you have found me, Cressa said, we have to plan how to reconquer the realm. Then we can fetch our rascal home.
I propose, said Ambrice, that in 2 days' time we sail for Pelagos. Sea Wind and Sea Maiden are to rendezvous with Sea Pearl there. I also hold the Magistrar of Pelagos in high regard. We could hold a council to decide on the best course of action.
Cressa assented. Ambrice coaxed her to eat some melon and flatbread and reported that her wounded were recovering as well as could be expected. By evening, she felt strong enough to rise with the help of Ambrice's strong arm and make the rounds of her men. These severely injured slept in the oblivion of poppy juice. The merely hurt gathered around a bright fire of driftwood, scarfing down a hearty meal prepared by the cooks from Sea Pearl, swapping stories about the skirmish and telling the other crew about all their adventures. They cheered when they saw Queen Cressa and made room for her in their circle. Sina rushed to throw down a blanket for her to sit on, while Kinley fetched her a bowl. Cressa laughed with the group about Smoke the Pirate Killer, Bashkim and his oar, Wild Man Darius and his crutch, and even the Queen of the Muskmelons. Clemson made a little ceremony over returning her antique dagger with catamounts carved into each side of the handle.
Is this the first time I felt welcomed and admired amongst my people?
2 more days passed while sailors replaced Sprite's mast and restrung the rigging. Crew from Sea Pearl filled in the Sea Sprite's roster. Cressa, her shields, the non-walking wounded, and the horses loaded onto the larger and more comfortable carrack. Under a bright blue sky that brought out the ocean's clear turquoise hue, they set their course for Pelagos.